Okay, if you were here last week, we discussed what we were going to do with the class, whether or not we would try to wrap it up here before the summer series, or extend it then after the summer series. And so then tearing through the book here and looking at it, and I think it is best, as we had thought last week, to go ahead and wrap everything up. In the next 3 weeks, we'll have this class, one more class, and the class after that. So a total of three. Then that fourth week will be the start of the summer series, and Jerry will be up for that. So three more classes. We're going to have a couple of different topics, maybe two or three at a time now, as we've already covered the really major blocks of topics that you have in the book. Ultimately, I think it looks like we will have covered really all the major topics. There will be a collection of very standalone individual verses that we'll not be getting into, but the great majority of the book, of course, we will have covered. So it's really going to work out very well. So starting tonight, let's take a topic that we touched on lightly as we were dealing with Kings last week. It was the last verse we looked at last week. There are a number of verses, I think it's five or six, that are on the topic of alcohol. So let's take the first one here, which is in chapter 20 and in verse 1. In 20 and verse 1, wine is a mocker and strong drink a brawler, and whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. And so there's one that is not directed at a king, as if they would be in a separate sort of a category, but for very general use. And we are given two different qualities of the alcohol, and we're also given two different kinds of alcohol. And I've never felt really strong about this, and I know I've done studies on it, I've read whole books on it, as a matter of fact. But you get conflicting information on this, and so I really don't feel, super dogmatic about it. But it appears that wine would have a lesser alcoholic content than strong drink. Maybe Jerry or somebody else could help us with this as far as looking at other passages, and we're not going to do that tonight. We're going to stay in Proverbs. There's quite a bit in the rest of the Bible about alcohol as well, but what we have here is a statement about two different kinds or levels of alcohol. Wine is the mocker. Strong drink, apparently something stronger than wine, is a brawler. And whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. Now, with the first line right there, there's kind of two ways you can go on this. The first, I think, is the more common way that it's understood. And particularly when it says strong drink is a brawler, you will usually hear, preachers talk about how it is that when people get drunk, then many get pugnacious and have a tendency to get involved in fights and that sort of a thing. And so, that's the idea that is here. And that may be the case. Sometimes people who also are wine drinkers do get sort of obnoxious, and they'll mock other people and sort of pick fights and that sort of thing. And so both the mocker and the brawler does have a history of going along with being a behavior that those who drink will sometimes engage in. And so that's fine. That may be the idea that is in view there. But there's a second way of looking at that, and it's this other way that I myself think he had in mind. And I think what he's trying to say is that you, the drinker, are the victim of both of these things. So wine is mocking you, and strong drink is beating you up. Strong drink is picking a fight with you. Strong drink is your opponent, okay? And then whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. So when one gets drunk and one allows himself to be intoxicated, you lose your control because of the alcohol. That is just foolish. That is just unwise. Smart people, wise people, don't do that. If you have your wits about you, then you wouldn't drink in the first place because you want to be wise. Now, maybe this would have been a good verse to have earlier in all of our discussions because we had so many verses about wisdom and so many verses about foolishness. I chose to hold it out, for the block here on alcohol. But, the book has had just dozens and dozens of passages that had to do with wisdom. It started off by telling us that it was going to give us wisdom. And wisdom was personified as speaking to us throughout most of the whole first chapter and continuing into the second chapter. And so, you know, wisdom is the theme of the entire whole book. Well, if that's what you want, then what you don't want is alcohol of any type or degree or kind. Wine's a mocker. Strong drink is a brawl. Now, what always then is the next thing that comes up? So go ahead, raise your hand. I understand that you find people drinking in Scripture, and you find places where, even in the New Testament, you know, Paul recommends it for Timothy's off infirmity. You know, so the question arises is, you know, how should a Christian relate to alcohol? Is it a sin to drink any amount at all? So that if, you know, this last week or two I've had trouble with the allergies and all that, you know, and so I've been drinking cough medicine. Well, if you look at the cough medicines, what do you find is in there? Okay, so did I commit a sin because I was coughing my head off, or was I foolish and unwise, you know, because I started, you know, using cough syrup? Well, you know, I don't think anybody really thinks so. And so, you know, usually there'll be a good discussion if there is tonight. You know, I'm fine with that. I'm prepared for that. But in a nutshell, just so you know where I stand anyway as your new preacher, you know, I don't believe the Bible says that the drinking of alcohol is a sin per se. I don't believe the Bible teaches Old Testament or New Testament that you have to be a teetotaler to be pleasing to God. And that if you drink wine on occasion, or you have a beer, or you, you know, drink in some other form, you know, with control, that still necessarily you're committing a sin. What I think is that that's just very, very foolish. It's not wise. So I'm a teetotaler, and I have been since I was baptized into Christ. I've had one drink of wine after I was baptized into Christ. It was about 3 months after I was baptized into Christ, which means it would have been in 1973. That's the last drink that I had anyway. Now me, I think that's wise. I don't think it would be a matter of sin, and 3 months after I was baptized, when I had that glass of wine with my dinner in a restaurant on the beach in Southern California by myself, you know, before I got married, that, you know, I don't think I committed a sin. But we could spend a whole night, I know, and maybe several more, you know, talking about this topic and all the ins and outs. I just think it's a good idea to take Solomon's advice. He's the kind of a guy who seemed like he knew what he was talking about. So what did he say? Being intoxicated is what? Not wise. So if you are one of those who can absolutely never make the mistake, and you could drink and never be intoxicated, and I don't think such a person even exists, if you're that one, you know, well then good luck with that. But the fact of the matter is that most people who choose to imbibe will have problems of some form or another. And at the lowest level, brethren, it will give people pause when folks find out that you are a social drinker, or with your meal, even if you were born in Germany. I've heard all the arguments, you know, and all that. I know. But still, young Christians, all kinds of people, when they find out, are going to have a problem. They're going to have to wrestle with what is going on there. Your influence is not very helpful in that regard. That's the lowest level I know. That's just not wise. Judy, you have time. For his stomach off and fermenting. That's absolutely correct. And so that verse, above all others, I think proves that it's not a sin. You can't imagine God saying, Timothy, commit a little adultery for your stomach's off and fermenting. You don't do that. It's a sin, and so that's the way it is. And so it's not a sin in and of itself. It is just so terribly dangerous. So, we got three people, I think, that are graduating from high school, right? So if they're graduating from high school, what are they looking for? One of two things. They're either going off to college, or they're looking for a job because the folks are about to kick them out of the house. And so you'll hear one of those two things. I would not recommend being a snake handler, even if there's a lot of money in it.
So if you want to handle rattlesnakes and cobras and the rest of that, you know, well, fine. It's not a sin, but what? Maybe not the greatest of all occupations, you know, that you might be looking for. So I realize a lot of discussion, a lot of thought goes into this. I hope I'm making myself clear. It is not a sin. It's just not wise either. So whenever people come at me, and they often have in the 40 years I've been a Christian, you know, and they want to argue all of this about how it's good and it's helpful, you know, and they've never had a problem and they've been doing it since they were children because they were born in Italy and so they, you know, were raised to it genetically, they're stronger and all that. I've heard them all, you know. But in the end, what did Solomon say? He said it was unwise. So when people come and they argue with me about their right to be unwise, what do you fools out there? Well, sure, you have a right to be unwise. Why would you want to be? So what's the deal with that? So, okay, you convinced me. You have proven to me that you have a right to be foolish. Now, how do you suppose I'm going to feel about that? Maybe not a good idea. Okay, so, any kind of question on that one, though? It's really pretty straightforward. Okay, so then there's this, well, yeah, go ahead, Carol.
Well, I think one of the things that the difference between the wine and the cobra is that the wine is strong drink, when you're drinking the strong drink, you may never know how much somebody put in the glass if somebody serves you. With wine, you can either, like they did in the olden times, water it down, or you go with, you know, they don't usually add anything to a glass of wine. So the strong drink is much more deadly if, you know, a possibility.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. There's so many variables, and everybody's body is different. As you know so well by this time, I've told you 100 times, you know, I taught driver's ed for over 3 years. We had only topic we had two classes on was alcohol. And one of the first things they tell you is that the female body is different than a male body. And the female body reacts to alcohol more quickly and strongly than a male body does. Pound for pound, takes the same weight, she gets drunker quicker. And that's the nature of being female. And so there's a variable just to start with, and then body weight, and then your genetics, and a thousand other things. There's, to my way of thinking anyway, brethren, there's only one way to know for sure whether or not you will become an alcoholic. Only one way to know if you have that weakness. How do you find out? Start drinking. And then when you find out, what? It's too late. This is what's foolish about it. This is what's unwise about it. Going to the first thing that Carol said as she was leading into that, the other thing we were to teach the kids is the first thing that alcohol impacts in your mind, the first thing alcohol impacts is your mind before your body. The first thing that is affected is your judgment. This is about the silliest line that anybody has ever uttered in the history of mankind. Is, I know when to stop. Because the first thing that gets impaired is your judgment, which is the decider on when to, yes. And so it's just silly, and what Solomon says is unwise. Well, I recommend you don't get involved in that game. 21:17 says this, he who loves pleasure will become a poor man. He who loves wine and oil will not become rich. Well, we talked about that one before in a different context where we were dealing with physical wealth. But, you know, that's almost tautology there. A tautology is a fancy way of saying a statement that is so clear, so obvious, you know, that nobody can misunderstand it. Because if you leave it all in the world today, what have you noticed about people who drink? Do they tend to be the most successful and wealthy people or not? Don't tend to be. There's plenty of exceptions, and I know exceptions to every rule, but Solomon knew what he was talking about. He was the wisest man that ever lived. God said so. So when you're arguing these cases, you're arguing with the wisest man that ever lived. Not a good idea here. Then comes chapter 23, verses 19 through 21. A little bit longer section now, three verses.
Listen, my son, and be wise, and direct your heart in the way. Do not be with heavy drinkers of wine, or with gluttonous eaters of meat. For the heavy drinker and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags. Again, similar to the preceding one, you know, about poverty right there. Now, again, I recognize it. My first statements recognized it. It qualifies the type of drinker, the heavy drinker. You can drink and not commit sin. Some people do in the Old Testament and in the New. It's just that Solomon doesn't recommend it. Right here, what I think is especially important for us to appreciate, brethren, is that when he says, do not be with heavy drinkers of wine, I don't necessarily think these words require that what he said was, don't be a heavy drinker of wine, or don't be a gluttonous eater of meat. That is not what it says. What does it say? Don't associate with those people. Don't spend time with those people. Don't be with those people. Now, just like when we were studying anger, and Solomon told us that if you spend time with angry people, what will happen? You remember? It was way back. I'm looking for a key word. Go ahead. Somebody give me one.
Violence.
Okay. Violence is associated with it. You're absolutely right. I was looking for a different one. What I was looking for is you will learn their ways. You will learn their ways. Brethren, this is the way human beings are wired by God. It is the way we are wired. And it's very difficult to fight it. We are a people, we are a creature designed by God to assimilate and to acquire and to appropriate data. And what we do is we incorporate it into our lives. Now, I've got three grandchildren. I've watched two of them learn to do things, one of which is the most fascinating of all things to me. Figuring out how to crawl, boy, that's cool. And our little boy, Tyler, our third grandchild, he learned to do it this week. I've seen the video. Okay? But the other two have already learned how to talk. How do you figure out to do that? Isn't it awesome when you watch babies? And you know, they learn to do it and do it fluently long before they ever get to kindergarten. It's not like you take a bunch of mutes into the classroom, give them a book, and teach them how to read. That's the way it works, is it? Now, something I noticed about myself that used to drive me crazy, and I just couldn't stop it. My wife's an Okie. So when I would go to Oklahoma, it would take me about 15 minutes. And then I would start talking with a accent. I became an Okie. And I wasn't doing it consciously. I wasn't trying to do it at all. I used to sell dairy feed. The territory that I was assigned was heavily, had a whole bunch of Dutch farmers there. And sure enough, I'd go on a Dutch farm, and the next thing I knew, I had a different accent. And I would be embarrassed, and I would think, well, they must think I'm putting this on, so I'd sell them dairy feed, you know? But I wouldn't. You get caught up in it. It's the way we were designed. So, if you spend a bunch of time with drinkers, what are you picking up? Everything about that kind of character. You spend your time with people that do dope. What do you pick up? Everything that goes with that character. You spend your time with angry people. What do you become? Angry. You spend your time with whoever, and what happens? And you're not aware of it. Now, something else I've noticed. Driving is regional. And the proper following distance has nothing to do with what they teach you in the book. Because in California, it's shorter. And in some states, it's wider. And you can go from city to city, and it'll be awesome. There, immediately, you realize, I'm in a new culture. Now, let me tell you for absolutely certain, something I've never seen before until I came to Eugene.
And I know why it is, but whenever you Eugenians,
of which I know one,
you know, go somewhere else, I'll bet you'll take that habit with you. Because your freeways are so very poorly designed.
Pardon me, but I've studied the topic.
They're terrible here. The on-ramps are too short, they're much too tight in the radius, you don't have time enough to merge. So immediately I get in this town and I notice that all the people in the slow lane, when they're approaching an on-ramp, automatically go to the fast lane. Why do they do that? Because they've been on those on-ramps before too, and they know the ramp is too short, and they know they don't have time, so they know they might have a collision, so they pull over and let the guy get on. How I wish the whole world would do this. It's so much safer. It's so much better. You learned it because you have bad on-ramps. I'm sorry. But they're pathetic. They're really bad. Saw another accident, by the way, on the Beltline coming in. I don't know what happened. It was a bad one up there. And both lanes westbound blocked and fast lane going eastbound. I had a cop car in it and that was blocked. Something's going on. But my point is, you have picked up a whole bunch of driving habits that only exist in Eugene. How did you get this way? Because you were with Eugenites? Who are you?
Who are we?
Oregonians, I guess. Okay, so anyway, this is what this is what Solomon is saying. So, brother, remember this. From the time you start crawling, you are on an information input mode that you automatically start incorporating, and you're not realizing it. Why do those preachers think that you ought to spend so much time with your Bible and the people who study it, and that it's better to come to the Sunday morning Bible class as well as the worship, and again on Sunday night, and then on Wednesday, and every class that is offered in between? Because we know this, you know this. You will take on a certain spirit. So, in 23, now in 19. 23:19. Listen, my son, and be wise, and direct your heart in the way. Do not be with heavy drinkers of wine, or with gluttonous eaters of meat, for the heavy drinker and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags. So now let's go back to the whole classes, two of them we had, on the topic of money. A lot more on money in this book than there is on alcohol. It's the same principle, isn't it? See, who comes to rags? Who comes to poverty? The lover of wine. If you spend your time with them, you not only pick up all the habits and speech patterns and everything that goes along with being a drinker, but you're spending all your time with the people who go to rags. And then you're surprised. How come I can't make any money? Well, your mind has been completely filled with the minds of failures. Don't do that. Okay? And by the way, I bought a book many years ago, a great classic in motivational literature. I think it was called The Richest Man in Babylon. And it made this point in different terms, but it starts telling this story. And a guy wants to be wealthy. So he wants to be the richest man in Babylon. And he's trying to figure out, you know, how to go do that. So he goes around asking for advice. Well, the first guy he gets to, you know, is the great sage. And he says, what if you wanted to build a brick wall? If you wanted to build a brick wall, who would you ask advice of? The baker? No, if you want to build a brick wall, who do you spend your time with? Masons. Okay? So if you want to get wealthy, who should you spend your time with? Wealthy people. Find out what you need to do that. If you want to have self-discipline, who do you spend your time with? People who are disciplined. If you want to sing, what do? Spend your time with singers. If you want to learn how to pray, what should you do? Spend your time with prayers. Okay? So whatever you want to do, go find the people who are the best at that and spend as much time with them as you can, and then these principles will bear fruit, and you will incorporate these qualities and give yourself a leg up on succeeding. That's the way the world works as God stipulates, you know, here in the book. Okay, so then the next one, chapter 23 again, but verses 29 through 35, and a nice long one here. Who has woe?
Who has sorrows? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? And that's a way of saying, I got this bruise, I got this cut, and I don't know where it came from. Who has redness of eyes? Well, answer, verse 30. Those who linger long over wine. Those who go to taste mixed wine. Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things, your mind will utter perverse things, and you'll be like one who lies down in the middle of the sea. Now what happens if you're lying down in the middle of the sea? You're bouncing and rolling around, you know, you're on the waves of the sea. It's not stable. Okay? Or like one who lies down on the top of a mast. Well, if you're up on the top of a mast, every action of the boat down on the sea is what? It's amplified. It's even greater. Down on the deck, you're only moving a little ways. But up above, you know, it's like this. And so if you want all that wobbling and crashing and falling around, you know, well, that's the place to go. So then he says in 35, this is the words of the drinker, they struck me, I did not become ill. They beat me, I did not know it. When shall I awake? I will seek another drink. This is awful. Isn't it just awful? And so here's this description of these people. Now, by the way, you should have seen what happened when I was looking for pictures of liquor, alcohol, wine, beer. I used all those search terms, you know, and Googled images. You know, and the first pictures that all came up were so beautiful. They're all of them just so beautiful. You go, you know, a picture of a bar. I was looking, trying to get different kinds of alcohol. And it was all the colors of the liquid and all the colors of the bottles. And it was just beautiful. And I remember just being struck at page after page, and it was all just so beautiful. All these colors. Okay? And the last snakes are really pretty. And then what? They got you. Once they got you, what are you ever got? See, so they don't do these things. You know, how many times have, you know, you've seen the wine tasters and everybody, the professionals, you know, with the raised pinky, and they know exactly, you know, how to swirl it around and get the bouquet and all that, you know. That's what he's talking about right here. He says, don't look on the wine when it's red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent. It stings like a viper. You're just a snake handler. Not a good idea. Not illegal. Not a sin in and of itself, although drunkenness in the Bible is always what, with capital letters? A sin. It's a sin. So you start off and it's all nice and innocent. And that lasts about one drink, and then what? Then you're crossing over into the borderlands, and the next thing you know, you're involved in sin. You're drunk. You're intoxicated. That's not wise. You're not smart. Bye. Yeah, no, that's a great point, and I accept it fully. You know, the expression could mean a range of things, but the idea only is, I don't know why. I've got this wound, and I don't know why. Okay? Well, that's why, you know, because you were under the influence, now you don't know. And I accept, you know, this alternate, you know, unequivocally, and sure. Okay, so lastly, this is the last one on alcohol, we'll go on to a different topic, but chapter 31 last week is where we ended our class, and so you've already seen this one. But I thought we'd revisit it again. So in the last chapter, let's go ahead and start at the very beginning. Verse 1 of chapter 31. The words of King Lemuel, the oracle which his mother taught him. What, O my son, and what, O son of my womb, and what, O son of my vows? Do not give your strength to women, or your ways to that which destroys kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine, or for rulers to desire strong drinks. lest they drink and forget what is decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more. Open your mouth for the dumb, for the rights of all the unfortunate. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and defend the rights of the afflicted and the needy. Now, again, 40 years I've listened to the arguments of these social and disciplined drinkers who all tell me that their families are happier and better because it's not illegal and they grew up, you know, in Bavaria. And so we always have one glass of wine in our meal, and I actually had a young woman tell me only a matter of a few years ago, it just scared me to death, but, you know, here she is, she's in her early 20s, she's the daughter of a couple who have been drinkers all their lives and originate in Europe, see, so they know, therefore, genetically, they're better prepared for it, you know, and here's this young woman, and she said to me, I can't imagine having a meal without a glass of wine. And she thought she was passionately helping me to understand its benefits and how helpful that it is and all the good that it does for the people at the meal and everything. And I was just recoiling at the thought of an early 20-year-old woman who can't even imagine having a meal without one glass of wine. Well, she's starting real early. Okay? Brother, what's the difference between I can't imagine a meal without a glass of wine to I can't imagine a meal without, it was just a little bit bigger glass, with a bigger glass of wine, to I cannot imagine a meal without two glasses of wine? How many people have gone down that road to complete destruction? Why do you want to get on that road? When Solomon's saying, don't do it. It's not for kings. So that this same family came to me and I had this whole lengthy discussion about the whole deal, you know, about how it was, I was a teetotaler and they weren't, you know, and how did I feel about it as a preacher and everything. He went through this whole thing. And when it's all done, you know, here's how I feel about it. Okay, you have successfully proven to me that you have a right to do two things. To be unwise and not ever be a king. Now me, I think I would rather aspire to responsibility and power and greatness and influence. I don't think that's bad. That's not arrogance and conceit. What we really need in the United States of America is a government populated by nothing but Christians, from the president on down, right? Okay? Well, we don't have that, and we never will, but still, that would be the ideal. And so, when his mother gives the advice to the king, it is not for kings, and you go, well, I'll never be a king, so I'm going to drink. What are you saying? What are you thinking? You know, what are you not thinking? This mother is giving advice to somebody who, hopefully, is going to reach the highest levels possible of dignity and power and influence of wisdom and righteousness and justice and judgment. They will be the monarch who makes the final decisions in the entire judicial system up to and including capital punishment. And you don't want to be somebody like that? Because you prefer your glass of wine and can't imagine a meal without it? Brethren, this is just not good. So sure, you have a right to be unwise and not to be as useful as this mother's son. I just don't think that's a right you'd want to exercise. If you were wise, you wouldn't. Okay, so now it's up to you. These are all the passages that we have. Rachel. Sure, as well as commercials, everything about more is better. You know, make you happy is the only way to be. Whenever I hear that one, I remember an ancient preacher who taught me probably 35 years ago. He said, the old happiness argument. And so very strongly he just said, I categorically deny that anybody who drinks is happier than I am as a Christian. I don't believe it is possible to be happier in this life than I am, than you are. And anybody who knows what it is to be a Christian and is serious about it, your life knows the ultimate joy. Your life knows freedom from sin, wisdom of the ages from God and the wisest men who've ever lived, and you have the knowledge that you are secure in an eternal life that is to come. Nothing in this life, nothing this life can throw at you, should be able to rock your faith. You're happier than anybody on the planet. 14 times, I think, the word joy is used in the four chapters of just the Philippian letter. So where did this idea come from? Well, it came from purveyors of alcohol, the people who sell it. Oh, that's where it comes from. Nobody, brethren, is happier than I am. Fire that. Nobody's happier than I am. You're just not. I don't think you can get any happier than this. That's not how I got here. Now, if that's what you need to get there, you may not always have a steady supply of that stuff. You know? And all your happiness is going to go out when the liquor store closes. You know, you're just in trouble. Don't go down that road. So, you all understand what I'm saying. You have a right before God to be foolish. You have a right before God to not be very accomplished. You have a right before God to head down the road to poverty. You have a right before God to be confused and not know where your wounds came from. You know, you got a right for all that stuff. Now, only one last thing I do want to touch on is verse 6. Give strong drink to him who is perishing and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more. I really don't think that this mother was now going to give the opposite advice of what she just gave to her son. I think what she did was to employ a teaching device so that she could contrast as dramatically as possible how far away you ought to get from it. She is saying, you are a prince bound for the throne. It is not the king's to do this. It'll pervert your judgment. Don't do that if you're going to be a king. Okay? So, you're headed to be the king. This stuff is only fit for people who are where on the spectrum? At the opposite bottom end from where you're headed. You're going that way, my son. Drinkers go that way. So, give drink to them. If you're going to make a conscious decision not to go that way, then alright, go that way. They're the people you would give alcohol to because that's where they end up. Rags and poverty and staggering around looking for the next drink in the morning. You know, all of that. Okay, so I don't think she was recommending it. I think it's kind of a facetious thing, you know, that this is who it's fit for. Well, it's not fit for anybody, but it's certainly not fit for the king. It's just the illustration she's trying to make. Okay, so enough on that. Now, here's a topic that Solomon spends a bit of time on. And it always also, and maybe kind of for the same reason, gives us a little bit of fits because of the culture that we've grown up in. So let's start with Proverbs chapter 19 and verse 10. In our culture, from the time that you first go to school, you will be taught that it is a morally, you know, evil thing. Slavery is a morally evil thing. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay, so we're taught from the beginning that the nature of slavery in and of itself, kind of like the way a lot of people teach the nature of alcohol in and of itself, is sinful. Well, it's not. Slavery is not any more inherently sinful than alcohol is. But I think in a like manner, it's not a thing we want to have much to do with. It is not inherently immoral. God commanded it in some cases, saw it practiced by his people in many cases, gave laws on how to restrain it, as some of which we're about to see, and therefore is not telling people how to do something that is inherently immoral. God doesn't do that. If it's a sin, it's a sin. You can't do it, ever. So here, slavery comes a problem for us. All the culture about us
would have us believe that if anybody ever says what I just said, slavery is not a sin, that that's just horrifying in the extreme. You know, hit the papers tomorrow if you're reporters out there. Larry Haverstock said this thing. But I will not accuse God of sin. And I will not accuse God of showing people how to practice sin. He gives instruction about slavery. Now, what God does, though, in regulating slavery, prohibits all of the things that we hate so much about slavery, the abuses of slavery, that have caused us to conclude that it's inherently evil. Every one of the abuses are inherently evil. Abusing anybody is a sin. But the relationship of a slave and a master is not a sin. It's a sin if the slave mistreats the slave. And it's also a sin, we are told, if the slave does what to the master? Give me a call. If he steals from him, it's a sin. What else? If he doesn't work heartily as to the Lord. Think about that one for a while. So the instructions that are given in Old Testament and New is that if you are a slave, you are to give your utmost to your master as if he were God himself. And you don't steal from him and you don't get lazy on him. You do the best conceivable job you can. And the greatest example we've got of that is who in the Old Testament? Joseph. So here's Joseph, a slave. What did he do for Potiphar? Absolute best that he could. And what did he get for it? Thrown in jail. Which I will suggest is a form of slavery. Now you're in manacles. You're behind bars. You are not your master. You have overlords. So in jail, what did Joseph do with his master? The best he possibly could. And in time, where did Joseph find himself? Number two over the biggest country going, the superpower of his day. Okay? The slavery itself was not a sin. But abusing it on either side of that equation was. Now 1910. Luxury is not fitting for a fool, much less for a slave to rule over princes. Well, again, we talked about that one last week. We were talking about the kings. Or maybe the week before, but you know, we had two on kings in government. You know, so this is a thing that's just not fitting. Slaves are not prepared to be rulers. They don't know how to do it. And not having any experience, not having any insight, just not being taught, not knowing how to do it. It's a terrible thing when those people get into positions of power. That's not who you want ruling over you. So that one we've already talked about. Let's go now to 29:19. 29:19. A slave will not be instructed by words, for though he understands, there will be no response. The New American Standard adds the word alone at the end of the first line. A slave will not be instructed by words alone, for though he understands, there will be no response. Now, it looks like to me, and you may have other ideas, but what it looks like to me is Solomon is pointing out, though, the natural inclination when people are put in bonds. Is it your natural inclination, or do you need a divine instruction to go serve your master the best you can, as if he were God himself? Is that your natural inclination? No! The natural inclination is that everything's against your will. So, when the guy starts telling you what to do, you understand every word perfectly. But when you go out in the field to do it, how inclined are you to do the best job you can? He understands, but he's not going to do it. See? Because that also is the inherent nature of slavery. Take away people's freedoms like that, and they resent it. They resent it. So there's problems with it. I'm glad we got rid of it. I just don't teach that God was guilty of immorality and sin when he taught that it was okay, as long as you behave properly in the relationship. So a slave will not be instructed by words alone, though he understands there will be no response. Now 29, skip a verse and go to 21. He who pampers his slave from childhood will in the end find him to be
what? Family. He's like a son to you. Now here's something about slavery. What's the good idea on how to treat a slave if you're the master? Pamper him from childhood. And then in the end, what will you find? You will find a man or a woman who is your slave who would die for you like your child would, who loves you like you're his parents. See, it can be wonderful if it's done properly. Brother, there's a lot of different kinds of people in the world, and not all of them are prepared to be vast holders of lands and to run, you know, a big operation, you know, in farming or ranching or business. That takes special tools and talents and abilities. Not everybody can do that. Okay? Those who can do that, who master those things, who have these capabilities, gifts from God, should go do the running of things. Okay? And then the rest of us should be what? We should be the workers in and under somebody who's very wise and treats us well. And in that system, then, everybody's where they belong in the system. And everybody's happy as they can be. And faithful like a child to his parent. We've got a really good boss. If you've got a really good boss, things are great. Do you want to get out of that job? No. No, you don't. By the way, you know, I mean, a little known fact, but in our own country, when we abolished slavery, what did a whole lot of slaves do? You're free! And what did they do? They threw themselves in the dust and begged not to have to go away. No. Don't make me mad. They were prepared for it. They didn't know how to do it. You throw them out on the streets like that, and they've got nothing and not a tool in the world to know what to do. They've been taking orders all their lives. Michael, I think you have a hand up.
Mine's the New International Version, but I'll probably be it. But my verse says, 21, if a man pampers his servant for you, he will bring grief in the end.
He will bring grief in the end? It's not the same thing at all. And that is the problem, Michael, to be very blunt.
All right.
Okay. The New International Version, brethren, supplanted the King James about 20 years ago as the most sold Bible in America. And it's one of the poorer translations out there. It's now the one you're most likely to bump across, but it's not a great translation. And so I've never seen anything like that before, and I don't know how to address it now, but I don't think that's what it says. Now, but I would suspect that because of the way we feel about slavery today, okay, that it crept into that translation. You see that? Because they're bringing grief to slavery. I don't think that's the original. So, but I don't know any Hebrew, and I haven't studied it at that level. Okay, so let's go to 30, chapter 30, next chapter, and verse 10. Do not slander a slave to his master, lest he curse you and you be found guilty. Now see, here again is a relationship between slave and master. It's really upright and wholesome and good and proper. And so now you're being warned about it. This guy loves his slave. And like the verse we just read, he's maybe been pampering him since youth and knows that that man is loyal to him like father and son. And now you come and you slander my son? No, that's not going to be met with a whole lot of approbation. And so, no, don't do that. That's just not smart. Don't slander a man's slave. And again, in chapter 30, the last one, verses 21 through 23. This is, let's see, 31, 30, 21, there it is. Under three things the earth quakes, and under four it cannot bear up. Under a slave when he becomes king, and a fool when he's satisfied with food. In my Bible here I wrote the words Woody Harrelson. That was the one that came to mind last time I was studying the book here. And 23, under an unloved woman, when she gets a husband, and a maidservant when she supplants her mistress. Saw a little bit of that in Abraham's life, didn't we? Do you notice the first one and the last one are really similar? Two things now that you know the earth can't bear up under. A slave when he becomes king, and a maidservant when she supplants her mistress. Don't know how to handle it. Brethren, if they make me the
chairman of the board of General Motors tomorrow, what do you know is going to happen to the stock? And then what's going to happen to the company not a long time after? It's going bankrupt. I don't know how to run that stuff. I don't really have a clue what to do. I'm not prepared for it. So if you spend your life as a servant, be proud. Be happy. Be grateful to God. Not a thing in the world wrong with that. But don't be envious, you know, of these wealthy people whose pools you're cleaning, you know, thinking that we just have to reverse things and the world will be great. No, we reverse things and that house is probably going to be like the house of Usher. It's going to fall because, you know, people are at different stations in life and that's okay. Find your station, do the best job that you can. Don't be embarrassed or ashamed if you're at the bottom, and don't be a fool if you're at the top. Both have their problems. Okay? So any comment or question? It's a big topic. I know it's huge. So any comment or question? I don't want to give it short shrift.
I'm a perfect teacher. Not even a question.
Okay. All right. So let's try to do one more tonight on humility. There's only just four, I think it is, in this one, really brief. But, you know, there were a number that are specifically devoted to humility, and I thought we'd be wise to see that, especially in the light of all these passages, 2 weeks we've had on Kings. Now we've been talking about masters and slaves. Let's think about humility a little bit, because that's what, you know, the slave certainly has and needs to have, but maybe the king too. So in chapter 13, and down verse 10, I should have turned, you're probably all there now. I'm going to catch up with you. 13:10. Through presumption comes nothing but strife. But with those who receive counsel is wisdom. Now you know that the word humility doesn't appear in the verse. I'm giving it to you anyway. What is presumption? It's just a form of arrogance. It's thinking you know better than everybody else. It's a type of conceit. If you're presuming something, you are assuming that you know better and you're doing it in advance. That's not humility. And what comes from that? Nothing but what? Nothing but strife comes from that. But with those who receive counsel is wisdom. So if you're not presumptuous and you're receiving counsel, what's the best single word that you might use to describe that? Humility, isn't it? That's a humble person. Well, that humble person is not creating a bunch of strife, and because they are receiving counsel, then they're becoming wise, and their lives will be better for it. Chapter 16, verse 18. Chapter 16, verse 18. Pride goes before destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling. Well, King James, I think, says pride goes before a fall. Okay, we've all learned to memorize it. Pride goes before a fall or destruction, and a haughty spirit before stumbling. So, the word humility is not in the verse. But the opposite of humility is in the verse, isn't it? Where are you headed when you're thinking too much of yourself? Destruction and stumbling. Chapter 18 and verse 12 says the same thing in different words. But finally, we get our word. Before destruction, the heart of man is haughty. But humility goes before what? Before honor. Humility goes before honor. If people recognize that you know who you are, you know what talents you have, and you're using those talents to the best of your ability, hopefully you're succeeding at the highest levels of whatever endeavor you're participating in. You're doing the best you possibly can. People will recognize it. But when you're doing the best and maybe a whole lot better than everybody else, there's a temptation there at the top of the pile. So what is the counsel from the wise man? Careful, careful. You may actually be smarter than everybody else in your profession. You may be more successful at it than the world's ever seen before. If you think real highly of yourself, get a Twitter account and rename yourself Amanda Bynes or Justin Bieber or how many others? What do they think of themselves? Lindsay Lohan, dare I go on. See, what do they all think of themselves? They're so much better than everybody else. The rules don't apply.
Reese Witherspoon just got busted drunk with her husband. What did she do? It was all on a camcorder. Do you know who I am? Did the cop care? No, she went to jail anyway. She was drunk and giving a cop a hard time. So when you get up there and you think you're above the rules, what is about to happen? Pride goes before a fall. And how many times have you seen it? 10,000. And we got Jonathan going into Sion right now. Don't go down that road. 29. Chapter 29. Chapter 29, verse 23. A man's pride will bring him low, but a humble spirit will obtain honor. A humble spirit will attain honor. So, that sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? A humble guy doesn't want any honor. If you're thinking you have to be honored, you're not humble. But if you are humble, people will see it, and what they will really appreciate it. They appreciate it. They know you're maybe higher power and more money and smarter and a thousand other things than they are. But if you treat them like you love them because you do, and if you treat them like equals because we are in the sight of God, if that humility shines through, then what will they want to do with you? Put you up on the pedestal and say, look, that's the way everybody ought to be. Whereupon you look down smugly and you say, that's right. I'm more humble than you are, and I can prove it.
Are you a lady who would never say, I'm proud of you, or I'm really proud of this basket I wove, or she would never say to her kids, I'm proud of you for doing this or that, because she felt the pride was not something that you should be proud of?
Now, I had a guy, not a member of the church, who about a year ago read me a riot act, because he said that the word pride is always a sin and there is no form in which it's ever right. Okay. But the Bible does not teach that. And so, I understand the theory, okay, and we all appreciate what she was trying to do. The word pride, like a lot of words, brethren, it has a connotation and a denotation. We went through this not too long ago. I'll do it again. What is the denotation of a word? Its definition in stark logical terms. What is the connotation of a word? You have an extension of the definition that gets you into a realm of application, which is a wider field. And in that wider field, a single word can be a good thing or a bad thing. Let me illustrate a Bible word. Lust. Good or bad? Good or bad? And what did Jesus say about the Last Supper? That he lusted to have that, to use the same word. The connotation can either be a good thing or a bad thing. Lust is only strong desires. It's only what object you pointed at and how you apply it that determines whether it's evil or good. Pride is exactly the same way. If you take no pride in how you appear, you're probably not going to bring very many people to Christ because they'll be put off by it. They're going to think, I don't want to be like that. If you take no pride in what your house looks like, you take no pride in your yard, you take no pride in the things that you do, what are your neighbors going to think about it? You're bringing my property values down. That's what they're thinking about you. You're negative. Okay? So it's all a matter of application. Pride is dignity and honor and integrity and uprightness and righteousness. If it is properly controlled so you don't get the big head, you can practice pride and humility at exactly the same time. Okay, so she was seeing, one aspect of the word, thinking of it as always a negative thing and trying so to avoid it. She's probably not instilling much pride in her children. There may be a real bad, aspect of that in years to come for that approach. Finding that balance is what the scriptures are teaching us to do.